the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Good evening, everybody.
Hello.
Good evening. My name is Simon. It's my privilege to take us through this series in Ruth. I'm really excited about it, and I hope you're excited about it too. You can find it on page 255 of the Green Bibles, and we're going to be jumping straight in at Ruth chapter 1. You may well notice that there are four chapters of Ruth, and we have three evenings on Ruth. Here's the plan. The plan is tonight, chapter 1, next week, the ambitious effort of 2 and 3. Yeah, I know, that got a real woo. And then finally, Ruth chapter 4. So we'll see how we go with that. So if you would like to look out Ruth chapter 1, and we'll make a start. In the days when the judges ruled. That's Ruth 1, verse 1. That's our context, that's our setting, that's our time period. It's in the days of the judges. If you open up your green Bible like that in front of you and have a look just to the left of Ruth, you will find the book of Judges. It's a time period where, running from the death of Joshua in the Old Testament right through to the coronation of King Saul. And we start with Ruth chapter 1, verse 1, in the days when the judges ruled. So it might be helpful for us to ask, what were those days like? What were those days when the judges ruled like? Maybe you can remember that refrain that runs through the book of Judges. It comes up again and again, and we find it. It's the very last verse in the book of Judges. It gives a neat summary about what the time was like when Ruth was written. So Judges 21 and verse 25. So last verse of Judges. We don't even have to move page. Yeah. So verse 25. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as they saw fit. That's the context for Ruth. Everyone did what they saw was fit. No king in Israel. In fact, perhaps a bit more memorably, if you know any other versions of the Bible, it is known as everyone did what was right in their own eyes. So that's the spirit of the age, doing what's right in your own eyes. That's the context. So I thought, right at the very beginning of the series, I'll give you a couple of reasons that I think Ruth could have a real impact on our walk with the Lord. So here's a couple, see what you think. Hopefully you can see those. So I've titled that, Why Should You Listen? Why should you read? Why should you study? Why should we take a look at the book of Ruth? So number one, I think it's particularly relevant to our self-centered 21st century life. Take a look at that last verse in the book of Judges there. These were days in which everyone did as they saw fit. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. So the spirit of the age is one of self-centered, self-reliance, self-interest, self-help, self-importance, and self-determination. It's self, self, self. It might well have some useful things to say to the 21st century, if that's the case. And what I think it's going to encourage us to do is to throw off empty self-centeredness and go for a full God-centeredness. One of the big themes that we'll see throughout Ruth is emptiness and fullness. And I think this is going to encourage us to get rid of an empty self-centered life and aim for a God-centered full life. Number two, I think it's going to impact your home. I think it's going to impact your four walls and what you get up to at home. And I think that just because of the very fact that the book of Ruth, it zooms in on one family. We're in the days when the judges ruled, and that's nationally, there's chaos. Politically, there's chaos. It looks like the wheels are coming off at a global, international level. And the book of Ruth isn't going to talk about that at all. It's going to zoom right in on one family and what they're like. Hopefully, when we take a look at the book of Ruth, we're going to find the vital importance of those day-to-day familiar and homely virtues of love for God and love for others. At a time when it looks like the wheels are coming off nationally and internationally, this book reminds us that those rare qualities of kindness, friendship, loyalty, those are a big part of God's purposes in the world. And number three, as we work our way through the book of Ruth, why study it? Why take a look at it? It makes up and forms part of the intricate and expertly crafted family tree of the Lord Jesus. We're going to see how all of the twists, turns, and happenstances in the book of Ruth are all heading in a very particular direction. The whole of our narrative is going to kick off in Bethlehem. All of chapter one, actually, is going to start and end in Bethlehem, and at a time when there's no king. And yet this story has got kingship and kings written all over it, because it's going to weave its way into and become part of the story, the big story of the Bible, of another Redeemer born in Bethlehem who's going to be King of Kings. So that's some, hopefully, some compelling reasons to listen. You might have some others. That would be jolly good too. So let's take a look at Ruth chapter 1. Neatly, you can split it up into three scenes. If this were a movie, we would have chapter 1 in three scenes. Verses 1 to 5, going away. Verses 6 to 18, at the crossroads. And verses 19 to 22, coming home. So first off, let's take a look at going away. Ruth 1, verse 1. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. We are in the promised land, the land supposedly flowing with milk and honey, and there's none. We're in Bethlehem. That's the house of bread, and there's no bread to be had. The barns are empty. The fields are empty. There's no food. We live at this point in time quite a simple time in Israel's history. Obedience would lead to blessing, meaning productivity, crops, livestock, defeat of enemies. Disobedience would lead to curses. That would include famine, livestock failure, and defeat by their enemies. It's likely at the beginning of Ruth, we've got a time of national curse. This is a time of disobedience, and Israel suffering the covenant curse of famine. And that famine's going to kick off the plot of our story. Now, verse 2, take a look down with me. The man's name was Elimelech. His wife was Naomi, and the names of his two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. The people of Bethlehem would have watched as Elimelech, whose name actually means "my God is king," and Naomi, whose name means "pleasant," head off to Moab along with their two sons. There's a famine, yes, but this is an odd choice of place to go. Moab was one of Israel's ancient enemies. They are on the blacklist. Deuteronomy 23 will tell us that no Moabite for 10 generations can join God's people, Israel. And as we work our way through, we're going to have a look at loads of different characters. We've got Ruth, we've got Naomi, we won't meet him today, but we've got Boaz. And as we work our way through, we'll try and put ourselves in different people's shoes. One of the people who I'd like us to consider is the entire people of Bethlehem. I think we can get some great stuff from this story if we put ourselves in the shoes of the people of Bethlehem. What did they see when this promising young family left the promised land? Do you think the actions of that family, are they wise or are they foolish? They're not criticized down here at all. And different commentators think differently on this. But it seems to me that in the context of Judges, this little family should have been seeking grace and mercy from God in the promised land, in that place that was meant to be flowing with milk and honey when everything was running right. But what they've done is embody the very spirit of the age, do things that are right in their own eyes. They're going to do what seems right to them. And so they head off, they take matters into their own hands, and things unravel in Moab. Verse 3, take a look. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. After they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. The scene ends with these crushing words. Verse 5, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. She's lost everything. She's empty of husband, empty of sons. And we've got to remember, this is a time in biblical history where the world revolves around husbands and sons. Not only is she grieving and utterly empty, but suddenly she's actually incredibly vulnerable too. And I think this makes our story all the more interesting, that in a world of husbands and sons, this book's going to revolve around wives and daughters. We get displayed here prominently and clearly at the beginning of our story that it's going to be a story about wives and daughters, about a woman's role in God's purposes and plans. And in fact, by the very end of our book, Ruth is going to get this amazing accolade that the people of Bethlehem are going to say to her, you are of more worth to Naomi than seven sons. And that means a great deal in Old Testament terms. And we could probably do a really, really great study of Ruth just looking at femininity and masculinity, and a positive articulation of those two things from the Bible. But as we end verse 5, we might be asking ourselves a couple of questions. What future does Naomi have? Does she have any? Can she ever recover from this? Is there any hope for her? And what of the Moabite wives, Orpah and Ruth? What next for them? Will there be any redemption, any hope, any salvation? And remember, these are no ordinary days. These are the days of the judges. This is a dark, difficult time. So let's move on with our scene. And we're now going to move from that scene of emptiness, where the family have gone away and Naomi is left alone, to a new scene. And this scene takes place at the crossroads. It takes place at a crossroads somewhere between Moab and Bethlehem. Now, if we were Hebrew speakers, is anyone a Hebrew speaker? Paul, you're learning a little bit, aren't you? If we were Hebrew speakers, I'm assured that we'd be in no doubt what this chapter was about, actually. Because there's a word in chapter 1 that's repeated 12 times. It's the word shub. No idea if I'm pronouncing that right. And that is the word for return. And so any time you see, we're going to take a read from verses 6 to 21, and any time you see return, back, go back, going back, turn back, or brought back. That's all this one word, shub. And so if we'd unraveled the scroll and read the Hebrew of Ruth 1, we'd be in no doubt what this passage was about, which would just ensure that we were absolutely on the right track, wouldn't it? So let's take a look from verse 6 onwards. Let's have a read together and see what we can find. When Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, she and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she'd been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show kindness as you've shown kindness to your dead and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." Then she kissed them goodbye and wept aloud and said to her, "We will go back with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters, it is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has turned against me." At this, they wept aloud again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. "Look," said Naomi, "your sister-in-law is going back to her people and to her gods. Go back with her." But Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me." When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. And we just want to read on to 19 to 21 as well. So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them, and the women exclaimed, "Can this be Naomi?" "Don't call me Naomi," she told them. "Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." Well, Naomi is far away from home in verse 6, and news arrives from her hometown. A couple of different things happen when you hear news from home. Maybe there's a bit of elation you're hearing from folks back home, but maybe there's also a bit of sadness and loss and grief and distance when you hear as well. It can also intensify feelings of loss and guilt. Naomi hears in verse 6 that God has visited his people and given them food. And no doubt she'd be delighted that her hometown is doing well again. The days of famine are over. But can you see the tough truth in verse 6 as well? Have a look. What about the tough truth there? The Lord visited his people. What about Naomi? We're left asking, isn't she one of God's people? And why is she no longer counted amongst them? It's these questions that prompt Naomi to make a move. And we hear of our first return in verse 6. It's time to return. It's time to come home. And Naomi's situation, it's remarkably similar to that of the prodigal. She finds herself sitting downcast in a faraway country and thinking of home and her own emptiness. In fact, when the prodigal comes to his senses and heads home, he says, "How many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread, but I perish here with hunger?" The similarities continue because just like the prodigal, It's not intended to be a joyous homecoming. This is going to look like coming back defeated and beaten up. You recall that the very best that the prodigal can imagine is coming back as a servant or coming back as a slave. I think Naomi here feels something pretty similar. She can't see any brightness ahead for her. She certainly has no hopes of redemption and restoration. She expects very little from God for herself and probably even less for her daughters-in-law. She intends to make the journey alone. She is a kind and sensible woman and desires the best for her girls, Ruth and Orpah. She's clearly spelled out that there's going to be no material benefit for them following her back to Judah. In fact, she suggests that things will only get worse for them if they stick with Naomi. In fact, in her present state of mind, Naomi thinks Ruth can expect more from the gods of Moab than the God of Israel. She's a fascinating character, and I've loved looking into her in the week that's just gone. She's incredibly complex. She's, in many ways, she's more interesting than Ruth and Boaz because she's just got so much more depth and levels to her. In fact, her life circumstances have had such an impact on her that she thinks they've affected her very identity and who she is. This is where Naomi's situation actually sounds really, really contemporary. Naomi feels that her pleasant name in verse 20 no longer suits her, and that Mara, bitter, is a bit more suitable for her. She's kind of self-identifying as bitter. She believes that the tragic circumstances of her life are actually going to win out and they're going to end up defining her. She self-identifies as empty, verse 20. Quickly overlooking and ignoring that huge asset who's right next to her, Ruth. I wonder how Ruth heard those words, "The Lord brought me back empty." In her depressed state of mind, Naomi's so wrapped up in herself at this point that Ruth is valued at less than nothing. The very person who's going to be more to her eventually than seven sons. Well, let's also take a look at how Naomi describes the events of the last few years. Take a look. We get these amazing contrasts in verse 21. I went away full, and the Lord brought me back empty. It's Ruth who went away, and it's the Lord who's bringing her back. She's saying she went away full, and the Lord's brought her back empty. But I think in all of this, we've just got to spot that the big, big thing is that word that we weren't allowed to miss if we were Hebrew speakers, shub, return, coming back. No matter how dejected she feels, she has come back. She's come home. And that is the most important thing. Are you weary, drained, bitter even? With high expectations or low expectations, the call is to come back and to come back to the Lord's place and to come back to him. Let's take a look at Ruth again on the crossroads. She, in fact, has a costly return. Our story, it begins and ends in Bethlehem, but its center point is right here on the crossroads between Moab and Bethlehem. You can really feel the drama of the moment. Orpah, who clearly loved her mother-in-law dearly, that was a sincere and real love, has been convinced reluctantly to return home. It's the only visible, smart, and sensible option. Yet Ruth is refusing, and she's described as clinging to Naomi. Then we see that the young woman Ruth has more faith in the God of Israel than Naomi herself. She isn't simply loyal to her mother-in-law, but loyal to the God of Israel. So she utters those famous words, "Don't urge me to leave you or turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me. And judging by what Ruth says, this statement of commitment, this big statement of I'm going to follow Naomi's God and I want to be with Naomi's people, this big, big statement, she reveals that she knows God plenty well enough. She, in fact, phrases things in the exact same way that God talks to his people. He says in Leviticus, Genesis, and Exodus, you shall be my people, and I will be your God. And Ruth wants to turn that on its head and say, I want to have that same commitment, that all-in-ness to you, Lord. Have you made that devoted, all-in, all of life and to death commitment to the Lord? Is this the kind of gritty, all-in commitment that looks attractive or not? And what could be stopping you? I'm coming up in November for celebrating 10 years baptized. And as I was looking at the words of Ruth in verses 16 and 17, I'm thinking to myself, is that true now? I think I've even got a little video of it. So I watched it back, just thinking, looking at the young face, making that all-in commitment. Is it true now? Or maybe does Naomi describe me in much more ways? If we have made that all-in commitment, is it true today? Because no doubt, great as those words were, Ruth is known as a woman of noble character, godly character, because those words meant something. It was followed up by a life lived. But either way, for both of them, whether they're coming back as a costly return like Ruth or this dejected return like Mara, the important thing, like Naomi, the important thing is coming home. And that's where we'll end, and that's with Ruth 1 and verse 22. A harvest is coming. If we take a look at that final verse of Ruth chapter 1, there is one more to go if you just flick over. So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. And in fact, our translation there isn't really good enough. If we take a look at the NIV and the ESV, which are going a bit more like for like, we read this, and it's on the screen if you can just about make it out. So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law with her, who returned from the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. We're to notice that they're both returning. It isn't just Naomi, it is Ruth as well. They're both returning. We're working with some profound narrative here. Ruth, who's never ever been to the promised land, is described as coming back to it. So whether it's the costly kind of young-blooded faith of Ruth, or right now all that we can manage is the resigned, dejected, maybe, return of Naomi, whatever it is, the emphasis is on return and on coming home. The invitation is just to come home. Well, we might want to ask ourselves again, what's the view like from Bethlehem? Can you remember, right at the very beginning, the people of Bethlehem will have seen this promising young family strike out from the promised land. They may have asked themselves, as Naomi and Ruth came back, what future does this woman have? Can she ever recover from this? And we read in verse 19 that when they do return, the whole town is stirred. They're kind of getting this parable on display in front of them. These two women are kind of coming back into the city like beaten, broken people. And they're watching on and wondering, is God going to do anything with this? Is there any hope for these people? And these are the kind of thoughts they're thinking at the end of Ruth chapter 1. Where they're about to be in for a big surprise, and that we're going to see that as we journey through Ruth. The voice that tells the story, right here in Ruth chapter 1, knows far more than the characters that are involved in it. We started with famine, verse 1, and the barley harvest is now beginning, verse 22. That's not merely a statement about the time of year. Ruth is, and the storyteller is keying us up for a big change. Something's coming. The physical famine that marked a time of spiritual famine in Naomi's life is coming to a close, and we're told that the harvest time is now beginning. Are we being given a hint that we're also on the verge of seeing a spiritual harvest of God's grace in Naomi and Ruth? Have the plowing and the sowing given way to reaping? Well, I'm going to leave us there, and we'll pick up again next week. We're going to have that ambitious go at Ruth chapters 2 and 3. Read ahead, please. You're going to get loads out of it. I've taken those two together because we got these encounters with Ruth for the first time with Boaz. One happens in the daytime, one happens in the nighttime, and they're going to tell us a bit about how those two characters interact. But to whet your appetite for that for next week, let's have a look at Ruth chapter 2 and verse 1. This is before any of the action happens. The narrator kind of steps on stage before the curtains have come back again, and he wants to get us interested in seeing what's ahead. So take a look at Ruth 2 and verse 1. What on earth's going to happen to Ruth and Naomi? Could anything good come from this? Now Naomi had a relative on her husband's side, a man of standing from the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And we'll leave it there.